The following Dharma talk was recorded in St. Louis, Missouri in August 2012 at a retreat sponsored by Mid-America Dharma. More talks from their retreats can be found at www.midamericadharma.org. The speaker is Shyla Catherine, founding teacher of Insight Meditation South Bay in California. More teachings and information about her work can be found at www.imsb.org.
So tonight's talk is on full awareness, being fully aware. Or classically, it's called sampajanya in Pali, in the Pali language, and often translated as clear comprehension. Now, sampajanya, probably most commonly we see as clear comprehension. Sometimes we see it translated as clarity of consciousness, as full awareness or clearly knowing. Even we'll see it translated as focus on clarity. In the middle-length discourses, in the Satipatthana Sutta, the description is, clearly conscious is he in going and coming, clearly conscious in looking forward and backward, clearly conscious in bending and stretching his body, clearly conscious in eating, drinking, chewing, and tasting, clearly conscious in discharging excrement and urine, clearly conscious in walking, standing, sitting, falling asleep, and awakening, clearly conscious in speaking and keeping silent. When we find a list like this, the basic idea is in doing anything. If the Buddha happened to miss some activity, such as clearly conscious when typing on your computer, or clearly conscious when driving your car, he meant it. There's a clarity of consciousness that we bring in every activity, everything that we could possibly do in action. And that is physical action as well as verbal action. And the actions aren't just the speaking actions, it could be the silent actions. It's not just the eating of the food, which we often want to notice, but it's also the urinating and the defecating, which we may tend to not pay as much attention to. A wise mindful practice is going to include both a component of bare attention and clear comprehension. They're practiced together by knowing what it is we're aware of in the moment. What is the object of consciousness? What are the characteristics of that perception? For example, is it permanent or impermanent? Is it graspable or ungraspable? Is it satisfying or unsatisfying? Is it self or not self? Mindfulness is not just about noticing the breath, and it's certainly not about noting rising and falling, in and out, hearing, seeing, thinking, hearing, feeling, sensing. That's not what mindfulness practice is about. We're aware of what's actually happening, but we're aware of that in a broader context, because included in mindfulness is not only the object that we're aware of, but the causes and conditions of those events. What brought it into existence, and what is its nature? Our perceptions are rapidly changing, but there can be a calm continuity of attention that is focused, clear, balanced, and undistracted, so that we know the changing nature of experience with clarity. Consider right now, without thoughts of the past and referring to memory, and without engaging in plans or thoughts of the future or anticipation, without consulting the thinking mind at all, how do you know what's happening? What's occurring for you? Can you tune in to just that? Not thinking about it, not thinking about how it came to be, and not thinking about how it will change and what it will become, but just tuning in to what's now. What do you observe about that? Is there suffering in it? Is there permanent or impermanent? Is it satisfying or unsatisfying? Is it your experience that you can control? We don't actually suffer or have a problem with the things that arise in experience. The problems that we face in meditation practice are variations of clinging and craving and attachment. Problems arise in how we relate to things, how we conceive of things. And so you'll hear me and other meditation teachers asking, "What are you experiencing in this moment? Where is your attention drawn? How do you relate to that?" We're not trying to create some kind of esoteric spiritual experience. We're simply bringing mindfulness to present moment phenomena so that there can be a clear experience of what is impacting the senses. When we're undistracted and we know our experience as it arises moment to moment, then we will be present for what is, not what we wish was. So many people complain of having a distractible mind, or they might complain that conditions are distracting them. I've had students complain that the sound of birds or frogs was distracting, and the sound of air conditioners or people coughing or snoring was distracting. People have complained on retreats, actually to me, of that I wore too bright a color and it was distracting. Or that the decorations on the walls are distracting. But what can make something distracting? It's not in the thing itself. It's not the particular color or the particular sound. It's in how we're relating to it. When we open to the moment as it is, there's not much opportunity for distraction. Then snoring mingles with the twitter of the birds. The sound of the air conditioner and the airplanes intermixes and creates a kind of musical composition of just presently arising moments of hearing. Consciousness is arising in every moment of experience. Are you fully aware to what you are conscious of? Or is consciousness distorted and deluded? Is it affected by misperception? When delusion arises, it conceals the nature of both the object and the knowing of it, the consciousness of it. The Buddha identified delusion, moha in Pali, as being the root of all unwholesome activity. Delusion is present in every unwholesome state. It's present every time there is identification, there is grasping, there is attachment or craving. Greed, restlessness, that sense of imperative, it's got to be this way, anger, irritation, annoyance, fear, lust. All these can color the quality of our attention and distort our capacity to know things as they actually are. The afflictive emotions may distort what's actually occurring, and then we are not clearly comprehending what is happening. There are so many moments in the day when we are just caught up in delusion. And it's not that it's evil. It's just deeply habitual. It's helpful to understand and to recognize, what is the mind caught up in delusion? How do we identify a deluded state? When we're swept up in delusion, we don't even know that we're deluded. But there are moments when there's enough clarity to think, that's deluded. And you've probably had those moments of clarity when you can look on an action, a thought, or an experience and recognize how distorted it is. We can also notice times when the mind is free from delusion, when there is clarity, and let those moments resonate within us. When you have a moment of mindfulness, don't let it slip by casually. Let it resonate. Feel the wholesome qualities associated with mindfulness. Give it the space, not for attachment, but the space to develop, the space in the heart and the mind to have to make an impression, perhaps an imprint on our consciousness, so that we know this state that is wholesome, that is mindful, that is clearly comprehending. Let the mind incline towards the development of that. There are related terms that you'll hear in Dharma teachings that are related to sampajanya, this clear comprehension. They're not exactly synonymous with the clarity of mind, but very much related. You might hear of sati, which is usually translated as mindfulness, or apamana as heedfulness, or, of course, sampajanya as clarity of consciousness, panya, which is discernment or wisdom, avikepa, which is non-distractedness, yonisomanasikara, which is the wise use of the mind, and jagara, which is wakefulness. These terms give different slants, different variations, and so we might wonder, when we sit down to meditate, and we think we're being mindful, that we're practicing mindful, what are we really doing? What are we really cultivating? What is mindfulness with breathing accomplishing? It can be helpful to understand what we're doing in our practice so that we direct our efforts most skillfully. What should we notice? I suggested observing the breath, but what should you notice about the breath? Now, this is a simple question, but there are actually different right answers to it. If you're doing a practice based on the four foundations of mindfulness, you might notice the various sensations of the breath, the tingling, the coolness, the heat, the pulsing, the throbbing. You might, if you're working toward the absorptions of jhana, you might focus on the breath as a basic occurrence of the breath, just knowing the duration of an in-breath and the duration of an out-breath. You might focus the mind on the fact of the breath. If you're doing the four elements meditation, you might take the breath as a material object and analyze it as a material as for its material components. What aspect of breath is the wind element, the heat element, the water element, the earth element? What makes up this thing we call breath? We often use the breath as a kind of anchor to stabilize attention, to give the place give the mind a place to return to when it wanders off, it can come back. We can use the breath as a focal point to intensify our concentration because that can become very refined. And the breath itself is a versatile object because as the meditation develops, the breath can become very, very, very subtle. Extremely subtle. The sensations can become more subtle. The way of knowing the breath can become more subtle until the breath might also become not even the physical breath, but might be known simply as a mental sign or a counterpart sign or a knowing, a mental knowing of the breath without even the physicality of the touch sensation. So the breath itself is very versatile. But when we're using it, when we're being mindful of it, we also have to consider what is this mindfulness, this sati. The factor of mindfulness is to support the mind so that it doesn't wobble. It doesn't wander. It stays connected and aware of whatever it is directed toward. And so there is an aspect to sati of remembering to be present, remembering what our object is. Sati, mindfulness, always arises with a cluster of other wholesome factors. According to the Abhidhamma, the Buddhist psychology that analyzes all the various mental states and states of consciousnesses into their refined constituents, in any moment of mindfulness, there are between 31 and 34. Let's say 35 mental factors. Between 31 and, I was trying to consider compassion, which could be considered an additional factor. Okay, so between 31 and 35 mental factors. And in relationship to mindful of the body, mindful of the senses, it would only be between 31 and 34 mental factors. Now, I'm not going to go through the whole list of all these factors, but I've posted them on my website. So if you get into Buddhist lists, I posted a whole bunch of Buddhist lists on my website. But they'll include things like wisdom, attention, feeling, equanimity, volition, tranquility, faith, energy, one-pointedness, non-greed, non-hate, malleability, workability, lightness of mind, uprightness of mind. Lots of different mental factors. When we're mindful and clearly comprehending, we will be aware of whatever is perceived by the senses and how it's perceived, what's going on in the mind. We'll be aware when we are in stillness and meditation, and we will be aware when we are talking, when we are working, when we are showering. We will be aware when we are moving. When we're engaged in any activity, we'll be aware of the body in that activity. We'll be aware of the mind engaged in that activity. We'll be aware of the environment that we're in and the contexts, the causes and conditions for experience. The Buddhist commentaries describe sampajanya, the training in sampajanya, clear comprehension, by four modes. The first is clarity regarding the purpose. The second is clarity regarding the suitability. The third is clarity regarding the inclusion in the proper domain. And the fourth is clarity regarding the undiluted conception of the activity concerned. Now, this language might seem a little convoluted, but it expands into a rather precise and full understanding of what it is to be aware and what we can be aware of or what a wise application of our attention is in meditation and in life. These four ways train awareness in a comprehensive wisdom because they train us to take in the entire situation that we're engaged in. So I want to look at these four modes of clear comprehension. The first is clarity regarding the purpose. What is the purpose for something? What is the purpose for anything? We'll have so many different purposes for different things that we do. And how we engage in those actions will be affected by our purpose. This specifically describes discerning the wholesome or unwholesome intentions that are embedded in the undertaking. If our purpose is for personal advantage and greed, that's going to affect what we do. If we engage in something for the purpose of cultivating compassion and loving kindness and generosity and wisdom, that will affect what we do. We can do the same action, say we give a gift, and we can have different purposes. We could give a gift in order to bind somebody into an obligation to us. We could give a gift to embarrass somebody. We could give a gift out of an act of generosity and compassion. We could give a gift for its karmic benefit to us. Or we can give a gift to help somebody. There's the same action on the outside could look like giving a gift, but the purpose varies, and it's important to know what our purpose is, what our motivation is. And so we bring attention to consider our intention and consider if that intention is likely to be the cause for happiness or the cause for suffering for ourselves and others. Clear comprehension of the purpose is the basis of being able to make wise choices in life, to consider where is this action likely to lead me? What is it going to condition within my mind? What is it going to cultivate? What are the effects likely to be? You might consider this in your meditation practice. What is your motivation or purpose for practicing meditation? What is your intention? It's important to know what your purpose is, because when you have a sense of your purpose, you won't be confused when you hear various teachers saying slightly different things. You won't be confused when you read the texts and find that one sutta can be interpreted this way and another one can be interpreted that way. You won't take everything literally with a kind of fundamentalist attitude when you have reflected upon your purpose and your intention and cultivated a wholesome and wise purpose. A discerning person is not going to do everything that a teacher says. You only met me, was it yesterday? And now I tell you to do something, and just because I'm sitting in the front of the room and I happen to have the microphone or the teacher's seat, doesn't necessarily mean that I know what is right for each and every one of you. Now, sometimes I think I do. Don't we all think we're right sometimes? But we have to be discerning and consider, what is the purpose of the instruction that I'm hearing? And I appreciated that somebody in the question and answer period asked what the purpose of some of the instructions were. What did they develop? What was their function? What was their purpose? It's a discerning and wise question. And then we try to understand what the purpose of a meditation technique is, and we compare it to our purpose. Is that going to support what we want to develop in our practice right now? And if they sync, we try it out and we see where it leads. And if they totally don't sync, then we think, okay, that's an interesting meditation practice. It's nice to know that exists. Maybe somebody sometime will enjoy it, and maybe I'll enjoy it at another time in my life. It all depends on what's appropriate for our situation, we have to consider what is suitable. So this is the segue into the second aspect or the second mode of clear comprehension, which is clarity regarding the suitability. We reflect upon our purpose. We reflect upon the suitability of an engagement. Does it support our purpose? And then we reflect upon the timing, the method, the place, the surroundings, the conditions to see if it is a suitable opportunity, a suitable time for that right action. Even since we are speaking about concentration today, an example might be that we might have the wish, the aspiration, and have the intention in our practice to develop concentration. But then something happens suddenly in our lives. Maybe somebody dear to us dies. Is that a suitable time to focus the attention on just the basic occurrence of the breath? And to go into states of jhana? No. When something emotional happens and something really significant happens in our lives, it would be inappropriate to undertake a practice of strong concentration until we had first opened to and dealt with and responded wisely to the emotional landscape. So even though something may be wholesome and a great practice, we have to find a suitable condition for it, a suitable time. I have some students who have long commutes on buses and trains. Now, when you get on a bus in a big city, or you're on a subway, is that a suitable time to go into deep absorption states? No, it's a very suitable time to observe the mind, to be mindful of the body, to be present and aware. But it probably would not be a great time to, close one's eyes and go into some very refined meditative state. The noise, if you're trained in these practices, the noise is a bit of a distraction, but you can overcome that. But even so, it's not necessarily a suitable condition for safety. So we find the right time for practices. And in life, we find the right time for our actions. In speech, we don't, just because something's true doesn't mean we should say it as soon as we think it. We have to consider the suitability of the conditions and the person who might hear it. Now, when we're in a meditation retreat, we tend to slow down. It's good to slow down. I encourage you to slow down. We don't have to go anywhere. There's no rush. But the first night I was here, I had a conversation with the cook, and he was telling me that, he says, we don't have very many silent retreats here. He said the first time that this Dharma group came, he was quite nervous. He said they were all silent, and he said there were 100 of them all lined up out that hallway. And he said you'd look out there, and they'd all be standing there really silent and moving really slow. He said it was weird. And he didn't know why they were so slow. And then, why they were standing so long out there. And then he looked at the salad bar, and somebody was slowly reaching for the lettuce leaf, picking up one lettuce leaf and slowly drawing it towards the plate. Dropping it down, watching it drop, and reaching again. And he said everybody was just standing there patiently in the hallway for a very long time. So this might be mindfulness, but it's not clear comprehension. When we go through the food line, we don't need to rush, and we don't need to be speedy, But we should have a sense of how many people are behind us and operate our body in a relatively reasonable speed that makes sense for the conditions. It's interesting. I was thinking about the cook. One of the things that makes it nervous, with people nervous around silent people, is we're used to providing feedback all the time. You know, oh, that was a delicious meal, or oh, that soup was really flavored. What did you put in it? And a silent group doesn't provide that. And so they notice the absence and don't always know how to relate to us. But it's one of the things that we give as a gift to each other when we enter into silence, is what a relief it is to not always be measuring ourselves against the feedback of another, against the preferences, the likes, the dislikes, the expectations, and the wishes and the demands of others. We have sort of community rules and policies, and John covered those all very quickly, and there really weren't very many of them. Most of it's a matter of consideration. But when we're in the silence, we give ourselves a chance to let down and let go all the personal stuff that gets built up around what somebody thinks of what I'm doing, and what I've accomplished, and who I am, how I look, how I sit. I guarantee if you have a thought of what somebody else on this retreat thinks of you, I guarantee it's wrong. In fact, I'd be willing to place money on that. That you can go up to the person at the end of a retreat and say, I think you think this of me. Because sometimes I have students come up to me and say, I know so-and-so hates me. Or, I think so-and-so is very impressed by me, you know. We don't know what somebody else is thinking. So when we deal with this suitability of the conditions, we consider the action that we're taking in a bigger context. That's the essence of suitability. And that also can be applied not just to our meditation practice, it can be applied to our speech, to the suitability of speech, the effect that our words will have. It can be applied to our economic practices, what we choose to spend money on. It can be applied to our political choices, how we vote, and what we do with our voice in a democracy. It can be applied to social and psychological conditions. We consider what is suitable. Now, the third one, inclusion in a proper domain. That language is sometimes confusing to people. The Pali term is gotra, which means pastures. You know, the field that sheep or cows roam in, their pasture. What is the field that you give your mind? What is the pasture that you let your attention roam within? What do you include in the arena of your awareness? For somebody meditating on retreat, this domain of meditation is pretty restricted. There's a lot that we don't include in the awareness. We don't stimulate our attention with a lot of outside entertainments. We basically deal with what arises in the mind and what contacts the body. That's mostly what we bring into our attention, into our awareness. We notice our actions. We notice our reactions. We notice when we move. How do we get up from sitting to standing? How do we go from standing to sitting? When we reach for something, are we mindful of that reaching? When we lift something, can we be mindful of that lifting? Can we be mindful of every action of the body? We're sensitive to the composure of the mind and what happens as we move from the meditation hall to our bedrooms. Have we let the mind wander just because we've stepped outside of the meditation hall? And what happens when we enter our room and close the door? Ugh. Have we lost all mindfulness then because nobody's watching? Make that time in your room the most important time for mindfulness and meditation. That's your time to really watch the mind. If you let down your guard because you've closed that door and now you're on recess, notice that and see if you can bring your attention right into the body and observe every action you do in your room to get ready for bed, to crawl under the covers, to prepare yourself for sleep, all the bathing, everything. When we practice mindfulness, we usually practice the four foundations of mindfulness. Mindfulness of the body and breath, posture. Mindfulness of feelings, the pleasantness and unpleasant of things. Mindfulness of the mind, which includes thoughts and moods. It's recognizing the presence of greed, of hate, of delusion, to recognize emotions that arise. And the fourth foundation of mindfulness is to be mindful of the context, the functions, the interrelationships of things. So mindfulness has the potential to be very broad in its scope. We can narrow that field, though, because just because there's a pasture doesn't mean it always has to be a huge pasture. Sometimes the farmer brings those sheep into a pen, and sometimes the cows go into the barn. We can moderate the range that we give our attention, and sometimes give it a wide pasture, and sometimes focus the mind. And that's the example I used earlier today of the length of the leash that we might give a dog compared to the degree of the range that we might let the mind wander, that we might let the mind move through. Sometimes you'll allow that dog to run free and sometimes call it back periodically. And sometimes you'll keep it on a very close leash or harness even. And sometimes we'll let the mind relax and give it a little space to investigate and explore. But we'll call it back whenever it enters into unwholesome states, whenever it gets lost in a thought, whenever it gets pulled into desire, lust, fear, aversion, hate, reaction, whenever it starts to build up a concept of self and delusion. But if it wants to wander into different sounds and sensations, we'll give it a whole range of things to observe. But other times we might say, no, stay on the breath. I'm going to count up to 10, 5 times. And we have clear determination to bring the mind just to the breath for that period of time. It's like pulling in that leash. And just using a very short leash. So this clarity regarding the proper domain means that we define that domain. And then we are clear about the mind moving within that domain. If we don't define the domain, then the mind will very likely just get pulled into unwholesome states. But if you define the domain, chances are you're not going to include lust and hatred as something that you're going to cultivate on this retreat, right? Please say no. Yes. Okay, good. Good. So we define the domain and we're aware of where the mind wanders, where it strays. So the fourth mode of clear comprehension is clarity regarding non-delusion. And this refers to how we conceive of things. What do we see when we see a clock, when we see a recorder, when we see a glass, when we see a folder, when we think of a friend, when we feel a painful sensation, or when we hear the sound of a door opening or closing? Non-delusion with full awareness to our perceptions implies that we are not only seeing the thing itself, but we are knowing the characteristics of the thing. And what are those characteristics? We notice it's impermanent. And if we don't immediately notice its impermanence, we can pose that as a question. We can ask ourselves genuinely, honestly, is this permanent or impermanent? Don't assume it's impermanent. Look at it and see. Consider it. Discover it for yourself. The Buddha said all conditioned things are impermanent. But you don't have to believe him. Look at every experience that you can possibly find in the mind and the body. And ask yourself, is this permanent and impermanent? Until you know for yourself that all conditioned things are impermanent, or you come up with something that is permanent and then tell me. We might then also look and see, is it satisfying or unsatisfying? What does this mean? You know, sometimes we think, oh, this is really satisfying. You know, I love this. Whatever it might be, a particular sensation or a particular sight or a particular experience in meditation. Oh, I love when this happens. Whatever it might be, is it really satisfying? Well, the question of satisfaction rests upon the perception of permanence or impermanence. How can what is impermanent be lasting? Provide lasting satisfaction? It can't. At some time it's going to change. No matter how pleasant it is, it will change. So we're not just mindful of the various things that occur. We know the impermanence, the unsatisfactoriness, and we also know the emptiness of all experiences, all activities of mind and body. What is this emptiness? It doesn't mean that there's some kind of big hole within us or that we're lacking something. It means that we recognize that there is no fixed essence, no eternal essence to something. I say that I'm Shaila. That's a convention. That's a name. It's a conventional reference. But there is no Shaila in here that I can find. There's no Shaila in the eye seeing. There's no Shaila in the ear hearing. There's no Shaila in the tongue tasting. And there's no Shaila within consciousness that is knowing. Wherever I look, I have yet to find anything that I can say is me. And I haven't yet been able to find anything that I can claim to be mine. If there was something I could claim to be mine, then I could say, body, you're mine. I am the master of you. Don't get sick. Don't grow old. And please don't die. But I can't. It has its own nature. Every experience arises and passes according to its causes and conditions. It's not mine. The Buddha said, abandon what is not yours. I love that teaching. He said, abandon what is not yours. Great instruction. Let go of what you can't hold on to anyway. That's what we're practicing, is abandoning what is not ours. What we can't hold on to anyway. It's a delusion to think that we can hold on to the body, to the senses, to the mind, to any experience. And so when we see the emptiness of things, we see within that, that's linked to the seeing the impermanence of things, seeing the unsatisfactoriness of things, that nothing can be held on to. Nothing can be claimed as I, as me, or as mine. So with sati, sampajanya, mindfulness and clear comprehension, the mind is aware with full understanding of what is occurring moment to moment in the body and mind, in the five senses of the body, plus the mental objects. We recognize perception is arising, and they are not isolated phenomena. They are occurring in a dynamic conditions, and our very knowing of it is affecting it. How we know it, the perspective from which we know something, affects the experience. And you all know this, right? You've all felt a burning sensation, right? And sometimes burning can be pleasant, and sometimes it can be unpleasant, right? If you don't know this, the next time you feel a painful sensation, assuming it's not going to cause you disability or danger, just stay sitting. Don't move. Bring your attention to that sensation. And every painful sensation that I have ever experienced has some moments within it that are pleasant and some that are unpleasant. The concept of pain is entirely unpleasant, right? We all don't like pain. We agree on that. But when you look closely at some, so maybe your knee is, there's some painful sensation in the knee, and there's tingling, and there's burning, and there's pulsing, and there's throbbing, and there's this little tickling, and there's this coolness, and there's this warmth. And some of them are pleasant, and some of them are unpleasant. And when you separate out the concept of pain from the direct experience, and you start to be mindful of the flow of feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, neutral feelings, then you'll recognize that they're continuously changing. And what makes a painful sensation unbearable is not the sensation, it's the mind's perception of it. It's the way that we conceive of that pain. So with mindfulness and clear comprehension, sati sampajanya, experiences are known in the context that considers the purpose, the suitability, the appropriate domain, and the undiluted conception of the object. We maintain a broad understanding of the context, the effects, and the conditions that experience occurs within. If we're trying too hard to meditate correctly, to do it right, it's likely that we've narrowed the scope of our attention and we're just privileging certain objects and certain methods, certain ideas or experiences, and elevated them to have greater significance and greater meaning than perhaps they need have. Cultivating sati sampajanya invites an expanded and a balanced comprehension of things as they are. And in this way of being, in this way of seeing, we will find a composure in the present moment as experiences change and flow by. In the Samyutta Nikaya, the Buddha says, how does one engage in clear comprehension? Feelings are known as they arise, stay, and come to an end. Thoughts are known as they arise, stay, and come to an end. Perceptions are known as they arise, stay, and come to an end. One should live mindful and with clear comprehension. This is our instruction to you. Now, the term sati, mindfulness, rarely ever appears alone. It's usually in a compound. It's paired sati sampajanya, mindfulness and clear comprehension, or sati panya, mindfulness and wisdom, or anapanasati samadhi, concentration due to mindfulness with breathing. If there's only mindfulness, we may not have the function of discernment, of intelligence, to make coherent and useful sense of the experience. So with clear comprehension, with wisdom, and with that stability of mind that comes with clarity, the mind knows what is occurring without attachment. Sri Nisargadatta Maharaj says, "When you sit quiet and watch yourself, all kinds of things come to the surface. Do nothing about them. Don't react to them. As they have come, so they will go by themselves. All that matters is total awareness of oneself, or rather, of one's mind." This describes the totality of awareness. To inquire, to explore our experience deeper. What might be coloring perception? What underlying tendencies might have been activated by this perception or that experience? What is influencing our experience that we may not be immediately aware of? We can train our attention to rest in a clear knowing with a broad, expansive understanding of wakefulness, of mindfulness. We may discover that the present moment actually lacks nothing, that we don't need anything more to be free, to awaken, to be happy and peaceful, than what is already present with us this moment, right now. The present moment is complete just as it is. And this is what we have to open to. This is what we can be aware of. And this is what we awaken to. And through. There's a nice little verse in the Nalaka Sutta from the Sutta Nipata. Listen to the sound of water in the cliffs and in the gullies. The tiny streams gurgle loudly. Mighty waters flow in silence. So let's have a few silent moments, please.